Well, good morning, everyone, and I think most people have returned to their seats, so thank you very much for that. For those of you who don't know me, my name is David Gifford. I'm from the Transport Accident Commission down in sunny Geelong in Victoria. I've also had the pleasure of being the chair of the organising committee for this seminar, so I would encourage everyone to leave some feedback, in particular positive feedback about the seminar. Negative feedback will be dealt with appropriately. So thank you for coming back. And so I've got the pleasure of chairing our second session today, which is around technological change and its impact on general insurance. Just as was the case for the first session, the format will be fairly similar. We'll have our three speakers that I'll introduce in a minute. Each of our speakers will speak for 15 minutes or so, and then there'll be plenty of opportunity to ask some questions of our speakers by the roving microphone, as was the case. Once again, if you'd like to tweet during the session, the hashtag is actuariesinst, and the hashtag is GI Seminar. It's all about hashtags these days, isn't it? So our session, our technological change and its impact on general insurance session is sponsored by Taylor Fry. We've obviously already heard from Kevin from Taylor Fry. There's several participants from Taylor Fry here, so I'd really like to thank Taylor Fry for their sponsorship. We absolutely couldn't do without you. So technological change, each of the speakers, I think, in the first session spoke at some level about technology and technological change and the impact it's having on the industry. My favourite little anecdote about technology is that when I started working, I won't say exactly how long ago that was, I started working in an actuarial consulting team of about 15, and the shared drive that we did all our work on between our team of 15 had a capacity of 20 megabytes. So these days, 20 megabytes is probably about an average spreadsheet, and a photo of 20 megabytes is not unusual. So that's just one little metric that I always remember that just sort of reminds me how quickly technology moves. I don't know what the equivalent figure would be these days. I think our workspace is about 3 or 5 terabytes. When we look at the media, we're constantly confronted with the impact that technology has on our lives. I mean, you could list numerous, but even just in the session this morning, Uber's a disruptive technology. The impact that Netflix is having, and what impact that's having on the large movie studios, and of course Google and Apple. We're constantly hear about the impact of technology across the world. And so what we'll hear about this morning is from each of our speakers. Is the impact that technology has on the general insurance industry. So I'll just briefly introduce, we have from the TAC, one of my colleagues, Jess Trong, from Ernst & Young, Natasha Anning, and from ISCA, Professor Alex Colley. So first of all, to introduce Jess, who'll be speaking to us about some emerging vehicle technologies. Jess is a road safety project manager at the TAC. She manages projects and assists with public education, marketing campaigns in the areas of police enforcement, vehicle safety and technologies, motorcycle safety, drowsiness and speed. Jess is a psychologist and holds qualifications in science, genetics and psychology, and has a master's in psychology and health. Thanks, Jess.
We're not supposed to be talking about technologies. Thank you for having me this morning. As David introduced, I'm from the Transport Accident Commission. And for those of you that are not familiar with this organisation, we're a compulsory third-party insurance company in Victoria. So we're owned by the Victorian State Government, and everyone that insures their vehicle in Victoria pays a registration fee, and a portion of that money, which we call the TAC premium, then comes to our organisation, and we utilise that money to pay for people that have been injured or killed in a transport accident. So we cover things such as medical costs, rehabilitation, and in the event that they have passed away, if they've got any dependents, we'll look after their dependents until they come of age. Loss of income, any claims in court, we look after all that sort of stuff. And our business, 90% are claims related, so most of my colleagues are related to the claims area where they look after our clients. I work in the other 10%, which is the other. I work in the prevention side of the business, and I work in the road safety and marketing team. And our mandate as a part of the Victorian road safety regulations is to promote road safety and prevent accidents from happening. And what we want to do is to stop clients from walking through our door. So if the day that we're out of business is the day when we actually see a day where there's no road fatalities or serious injuries anymore. And that's exactly what we're working towards. And we're working towards zero injuries and zero deaths on our roads. And for us to be able to do that, we need to very much be people-centric. We need to place people's health and well-being at the centre of everything that we do when we're designing our road network for all our road users. And to be able to do that, we understand people make mistakes, and we understand that people have a very limited tolerance to external forces before they do become injured. So when we design our road transport system, we need to start putting layers around them to be able to protect them. And that involves working in the areas of safer speeds, safer people, safer roads, and safer vehicles. So these are the key areas that we need to invest in and look into, because each of these factors you will actually see involved in an accident. And that makes sense, and we actually want to prevent these tragedies from occurring again. We need to strengthen each of these pillars. And today I'll be talking to you around some of the work that we're doing in the vehicle safety space. So what's the potential related to vehicle safety? There's been a lot of research done around this area, and this is probably the most compelling stat that I've seen by Monash University Accident Research Centre. If we can actually upgrade everybody from the least safe car into the most safe car in the class of vehicle that they drive, so from a least safe small vehicle to the safest small vehicle, least safe large vehicle into the safest large vehicle, we can actually reduce road trauma by a third overnight. And that's with everything else on the road being equal. So if you actually use last year's road fatality as an example, we unfortunately had 249 people lose their lives on the Victorian roads last year. So if we could actually upgrade everybody into the safest car last year, we could have saved an additional 82 lives. And that's the power of vehicle safety, and that's the power of, you know, making sure that we've got the safest cars on our roads, and because it really can reduce road trauma very, very significantly. Many of you in the room, I'm hoping, would be quite familiar with the Australasian New Car Assessment Program, ANCAP. This is an independent crash body that provides independent crash test results to Australian consumers to inform them how safe their car is. And it ranks cars from a 1 to 5 star rating. And with each increase in a star, you actually have an increase in the 12% level of protection. So, you know, since this program started, you know, 20 odd years ago, we've actually seen a massive increase in the availability of safe vehicles on our roads. When the program first started, we saw cars that were regularly testing 1 and 2 stars, whereas on the market now, most new cars being tested have that 5-star rating, and there's a 5-star safety rated car in every single class of vehicle available. So no, it's no longer just about price. You can actually get a cheap, safe 5-star vehicle. And I think, you know, this video is a really good way to demonstrate how far we've come in vehicle safety terms. So this is a test between an old Chevy and a newer version of the Chevy. It can actually see when they crash the deformation in the older Chevy. And, you know, that's just a demonstration of the crashworthiness of the car and how far we've come. You can see the car on the right, you know, the person sitting in that car, the chances of survival would be very, very low. There'll be almost no chance of surviving that crash. Whereas the car on the left, which is the newer version that has a much higher safety rating, with the crumple zones and everything that's been incorporated, it affords the driver much better survivability. You can see it from the driver's perspective. It just goes to demonstrate how important vehicle safety is in this aspect in reducing injury and also reducing trauma. This is from the perspective of the safer vehicle. You can see with the addition of things like an airbag, it can actually absorb some of that impact before the rest of the force is transferred onto the body, and that's when the injuries and fatality risk starts to increase. So that's just a demonstration of how far we've come in vehicle safety terms. A lot of the cars... Sorry, I was warned about that, and of course, I didn't pay attention. I mean, that video was a show in terms of the crashworthiness of the car, how well the car is actually built, whether it's got crumple zones to absorb some of that energy. But another thing that makes a car actually safe isn't just about the way it's built, but it's also about the technologies that have been built into them that can help you either avoid a crash from happening in the first place or be able to reduce the crash severity. Mm-hmm. So in the past decade or so, the TAC, besides promoting the star rating of cars, we've also looked at what technologies are going to deliver the best road safety gains. So for the past decade, we've been looking at two key technologies. The first one is electronic stability control. Some of you may be familiar with it. Some of you might have seen some of the public education campaigns the TAC has been running over the past decade. How many people are familiar with ESC? A few people. Most of you, hopefully, if you've got a newer car, would actually have this technology in it. It's a technology that can detect whether the driver is understeering or oversteering and is at risk of actually losing control of the car. So what it does is, when it detects the driver losing control, it can brake the individual wheels to make sure the car actually keeps on track and doesn't actually run off the road and slide into a tree or other objects on the side of the road. So what we know through research is this technology can reduce single vehicle runoff road crashes by up to 30%. And that's one of the most severe crash types and most common crash types that we see in Victoria. So when a car actually slides into a tree, we know that the survivability rates are greatly decreased because there's actually a lot less protection on the side of the car to be able to save the driver. So technology like that, when we started our promotions, was in terms of awareness and availability was quite low. But since our promotion started, and with the government actually mandating that all new cars should have this technology in 2008, we've actually seen the penetration rate up in the high 90s now, 90% and over. So I know we talked a bit about government mandates. In this case, it has actually made a difference in terms of saving people's lives and making sure that in road safety terms, we're seeing a decrease in trauma. The other technology we've been focusing on and been promoting is curtain airbags. So these are airbags that would fall from the top of the door rail down, and this is designed to protect the head in the event of a side impact, either with the tree or with another vehicle. So once again, when we first started our campaigns, many people were familiar with front airbags and even side airbags, but had very low awareness of what curtain airbags are and what they can do. Obviously, any collisions in the side impact, the head is, you know, very fragile and very much at risk of injury. So a technology like that can greatly increase the survivability of the driver if a crash was to occur. And we know through research, once again, it can decrease the risk of death by up to 40%. So once again, that's why we were throwing a lot of energy into promoting this technology to the consumers, asking that they look for these two key features the next time they're looking for a new car. But there's also a number of different emerging technologies, some already available on the market and some you might have already heard about, either through advertising by car manufacturers or through your own research if you're looking at buying a car. So the one that we're heavily promoting at the moment is called auto emergency braking. So this is a technology that can, using radar, light sensors, cameras, detect if a crash is about to happen. And in most cases, the technology may warn the driver. If the driver doesn't actually take action, what the car is, it actually brakes for the driver. So in the event the driver doesn't react, the car will brake and actually either avoid the crash completely, or if it can't avoid the crash completely, it can at least wipe off some of the speed, which means that, once again, crash severity will be decreased. So it's a great technology. It's the next step towards automation. And once again, we know through research that it can actually decrease rear-end collisions by up to 30% and even more. So it's a new technology But it's also available on a range of different cars. But once again, awareness rates within the community is still quite low, hence why the need to promote and go out there and tell people about this life-saving feature and ask them to consider it for the next vehicle. And I thought I'll just quickly show you, this is one of the TAC campaigns that we ran last year to inform people of, one, what the technology is, but also how it works, because we know through research people are more likely to buy a technology if they know what the research evidence says about it and if they also know how it actually performs and works. Like a sliding door scenario of what can happen and what can not happen if you actually have AED on your car. So just a few more technologies that's up and coming. Some of these already out there. Lane Keep Assist, a technology once again that either uses sensors or cameras to sort of determine where the car is travelling within a lane. So if the car actually starts to drift out of their lane, what this technology does is gently nudge it back. So with this technology, it's actually difficult to run off the road or cross lanes without indicating. And there's a one level down technology called lane departure warning. So that's just a warning system. So when you actually start to move out of your lane, that technology provides a warning. This one actually keeps you within your lane. Intelligent speed assist. This technology has actually been around for about 10 years or so, but in terms of the penetration into the market, it's still quite low. It's a technology that knows exactly what speed the car should be travelling at within a certain speed zone. And once it detects that you're travelling above the posted speed limit, what it does is it actually provides you with a warning. And there are actually more restrictive versions that can actually limit the car to the posted speed limit. So through research and a lot of trials that we've been running within Victoria and also in the whole of Australia, we know that it can actually reduce speeding by up to 40%. And I'm thinking a lot of insurance companies are starting to look at some of these technologies where if you actually have it, you can actually reduce the premium. Driver drowsiness detection. Fatigue accounts for up to about 20% of fatalities in Victoria. So anything we can do to help reduce that incidence is a good thing. And there are some technologies that are coming into vehicles now that can detect whether a driver is drowsy and provide an alert. And some of those technologies include facial recognition, looking at the rate of the eye blink, and the one that we're testing in one of our project cars looks at the steering angle and steering wheel angle sensor and how frequently you're inputting into the wheel to actually determine whether or not you're tired. And then it provides you with a warning if it detects that you're actually not driving like you normally would. I mean, the next thing is around connected vehicles. So this is really vehicle-to-vehicle communication or vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. So basically, cars travelling around, if you all have these vehicle-to-vehicle communication, you'll know exactly where each and every car is travelling. So if you're coming around a blind spot and you don't actually notice another car, there will actually be an alert to actually alert you, okay, there's impending danger. And you can also have transponders on infrastructure to alert cars to different things that's happening on the roads, whether emergency vehicles are coming through. And that's probably the way of the future, where a lot of cars will be able to talk to themselves and as well as all the infrastructure around them to be able to help further reduce road trauma. I mean, you've probably heard a lot about driverless cars and Google cars a lot in the media, and whether that is upcoming, is it here? A lot of the technologies I've spoken about today, they're here and now. And in terms of the future driverless cars, they all will need some version of the technologies that I've spoken to you about. So auto braking, the car, driverless cars will need to be able to do that. keeping the car within its lane, lane keep assist would be vital. Keeping the car within the speed limit, ISA will be a very key technology. Connected vehicles, obviously with driverless cars, all vehicles will need to be able to communicate with each other because the driver won't be in control anymore. I mean, and these are, just when you thought airbags, you can't fit airbags anywhere else in the car, these are some of the places that I've seen at recent conferences where potentially you might start seeing in future cars, you know, an airbag in between the front seat driver and passenger to reduce any chance of collision and causing serious injuries. And also bonnet protection for pedestrian safety. So if a car was to, you know, hit a pedestrian, the chances of them having serious head injuries would be reduced if there's something to actually cushion some of that impact. And onto the driverless vehicles then, this is a large project that's been undertaken in Gothenburg, and the Swedish Transport Administration is working very closely with Volvo to develop 100 driverless cars by 2017. And there will be a large scale trial in the city of Gothenburg where these 100 driverless cars will be travelling around within a 50k closed circuit. And these cars will be able to drive themselves around. And what they're looking at is, what are the safety benefits? Are there any environmental benefits? Can we actually, you know, reduce our lane sizes? Because cars can be a lot more precise than drivers, so can change a 4-lane highway into a 5-lane highway potentially. You know, are there any efficiency, acceptability by users? And also looking at the interaction between driverless cars and cars that are still, you know, driven by ordinary people. So these are some of the things that they need to start looking at. And one of the last points is around infrastructural needs. If we want to start bringing in, driverless cars into Australia, we need to start looking at what infrastructure we need to start building and start improving to be able to facilitate the introduction of driverless vehicles. So it's probably not as far away as you think it is. And like I said, most of our cars these days already have some level of automation. If you ever use cruise control on your car, that's probably considered a level one automation. So, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, definitely you'll start to see more automated features, at least, appear in the cars. If you're interested in finding out more about any of these technologies or what's up and coming, you can always head to the TAC website, howsafeisyourcar.com.au, or head straight to the ANCAP website. They'll have more information around some of the technologies that they'll start including as a part of their rating system. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Jess. I think it was interesting. Certainly, I think in Kevin's presentation a little earlier, he touched on how that reduction we've seen in claim frequency has been driven claim frequency in motor insurance has been driven by technologies. And I think we've just seen a really good illustration from Jess of a number of those technologies that have had a significant impact there. Just speaking from a very personal point of view, I know when we bought a car about 5-6 years ago. At the time, the Volvo XC60, which was what we purchased, was described as the safest car in the world. I think it was one of the first cars to have the autonomous braking. So, yeah, it was certainly from my point of view, the marketing worked. So on to our second speaker. It's my pleasure to introduce Natasha Enning from Ernst & Young. Natasha is a director at Ernst & Young, and she spent 16 years in the Australian and UK insurance industry, both in-house and in a consulting capacity. She consults across a broad spectrum of the insurance value chain, including risk, pricing, underwriting, and claims. And Natasha represents Oceania on Ernst & Young's global telematics initiative. And she'll be sharing some of her insights about telematics with us today. Thank you very much, Natasha.
So unfortunately, telematics and technology doesn't help costs, so I apologise for my coughing up front. So today, I'm just going to talk about telematics and will it change in the face of GI. So I didn't want to do a presentation just on telematics because there's a lot of material out on the web, but also across the whole spectrum on telematics. I want to take a slightly different view on it today and take it from a social media perspective and then also tie it back to what we're seeing in the insurance industry in Australia. So the objective is just to give you a view of telematics and how it's been changing over time. It's been around for many years now and it's come through in different forms. And I want to highlight some key questions on the adoption of telematics in the connected world, or the connected car, as Jess has just mentioned. So just as introduction, so I think everyone in the room probably knows what telematics can be defined as. But it's a technology of collecting vehicle data, including driving data, and sending that data via telecommunications to a central location for analysis. This is something that might excite all the actuaries in the room as well. So just as a broader, to show the growth of telematics, the global telematics market has grown to approximately, well, we're expected to grow to 104 million new cars, have some form of connectivity by 2025. This increase in telematics is definitely driven by the importance of smartphones and regulations for driver safety. So it was interesting to hear Jess's presentation on this. So the smartphones have had a particular impact on telematics because they're easy. Everyone in, who in the room actually doesn't have a smartphone? Apart from Philip Back. He tries to avoid people. So most people have a smartphone. So everyone in this room, unless they have their location services turned off, is actually being tracked by Google or some other provider. So the advent of a smartphone has made telematics more of a realistic proposition in the Australian market. So just coming back to telematics and social media. So it was, EY did some social media analysis only in English language. So we've missed Portuguese and Spanish, but just to give you some boundaries around that. Around from the 1st of January 2010 to mid-June 2014. And what it was looking for was usage-based insurance and where it was discussed in their social media. What was interesting for me particularly is that it's discussed on Twitter. And I went and had a bit of a look at this to see what was on there. And there's a significant amount of information and also opinions around usage-based insurance. There are also many blogs, if you care to read them, around that. It's discussed on Facebook and it's on YouTube. So it's actually really interesting. So the majority of these, this discussion around usage-based technology occurs in the US, Canada, UK, India and Indonesia, which was an interesting fact for me, that our, one of our nearest neighbours is quite interested in the telematics or usage-based technology. So from this analysis, we did a word cloud around what was discussed on social media, noting again that there was no Portuguese and no Spanish. So telematics was discussed, insurance, privacy, coverage, premiums, so all the things that you would expect to see. Progressive, one of the biggest insurers in the States. They were all the words that came out from the social media analysis. So privacy is still very at the forefront of our consumers' minds and how that information is used. So just to add a little bit of my view on telematics, if I was to do a word cloud on what I think is going to be important in the future, this is what it looks like for me. So to me, the customer is core. It's the piece that we need to really understand better as a general insurance sector. Data will always be important. The power behind the data is part of our lives. And in this room, there'll be lots of actuaries who will be very excited by data. But it needs to be underpinned by technology and also analytics, both prospective and retrospective. So a word that didn't come through so clearly in the other social media word cloud was gamification. That actually has risen significantly in the last 2 or 3 years. And we've just had gamification occur within the Australian marketplace with the AIMI app. Excuse me. Privacy will still be an issue. Our our consumers, our customers, want to know that we are protecting their data. And this is something that we all know that we have to do and that all insurance companies are very aware of. But it's not specific to telematics. So just looking where telematics has come from and where it's going to, and also what that means for the business models. So you've got pay as you drive, you've got pay how you drive, which is more focused on the behavioural analytics, and then manage how you drive, which is providing feedback directly to those driving telematics. There's also, for me, a focus on the customer, and also we're linking it into the connected car. So the connected car is a reality, just as this discussed it, and it will become part of our lives. And it's actually a customer expectation now. To be able to deliver telematics, you actually need to evolve your business model or really understand what your business model is and how you can provide that customer proposition. And what is our focus into the insurers or participants in the insurance industry? What is going to be important to our customers? That's what we really need to understand. So just briefly around devices. We have our smartphone apps now. They're increasing in number across the world, globally. They're not expensive. Most people, apart from Phil, have a smartphone and you can use that easily. You've got your onboard diagnostics, which is the additional device that you add into your car. You've got your hardwired ones, which can be also from the manufacturer, but you can also add yourself if they're installed. And interestingly, in Russia, they're also using camera-based systems. So this is where the camera actually faces the driver. I'm not sure that they'll take off in Australia, but that's another means of telematics at this point in time, but it's more in the fleet space. So just touching on some global activity, many people will be aware of the eCall and the Irigloznas in Russia. So that's basically ensuring that all cars manufactured have the ability to call emergency services in the event of a crash. So this actually will support the car safety. And this is what the Europeans and the Russians have actually mandated. This also is occurring in Brazil, though there are some delays around this. So that cars can immediately call emergency services in the event of an accident. In Europe, in 2012, Italy, the Italian government actually brought a law in, I think it's called the Mondi Law, that requires insurers to offer lower rates to customers who opt for a telematics tracking device. Italy has been one of the leaders in the telematics space. There are various reasons for that, that it's still progressing and it actually becoming part of more mainstream insurance. So some points, and I know people will question me, I already had a question around that, what that $2 billion in written premium for its annual offer since Progressive started, but I wasn't able to clarify that. So Progressive has collected over 10 billion miles of driving data with their telematics insurance product, Snapshot. This is 110 terabytes of data. So a little bit more than 20 meg used to have data. No. So it just shows the enormity of the data that's being collected, and their premium is $2 billion in written premium. I don't know if this is annual or since it started. Also in the UK, the British Insurance Association has grown to nearly 300 cars and 2-3% of the market. Still not mainstream, but it's actually definitely developed in size. The thing that is interesting is, according to a survey that EY did, in the Chinese motor market, 80% of those surveyed believe that UBI will become a mainstream insurance product. So they're moving from a regulated motor insurance market, they're able to go to risk-based pricing now, and this is what they think will actually enter into the Chinese market as mainstream. So Australia, I won't go into this in detail, but we've got some UBI providers. We've got the Smartbox, Hollard, we've got Insurance Box with QBE, and we have the AMI Safe Driver app, so it's the gamification element. We We also have a Zurich product, which is more focused on fleet and risk management. To date, when I speak to Australian insurers, telematics is seen as a pricing mechanism to target particular customer groups. So our younger drivers, those who we believe are less safe, potentially, being able to target their pockets and the niches within those customer groups to ensure to be able to give them prices which are aligned with their driving behaviour. So coming back to my view on the customer, that I think the customer will be the driver for telematics within the Australian marketplace. We did a survey, which is available, that was looking at the key characteristics in customer relations with their insurer. So it's value for money. In my view, telematics can give us this, and easy to deal with. This is another attribute that our customers are looking for. And telematics may be able to provide this. So, excuse me. So just looking at the future, there's some more some questions really for those in the room. So questions and thoughts. So our competitors may not be traditional insurers in the future. They may be the Google insurance that we've all spoken about, and they are making inroads into the insurance sector. They are the people who will hold all the data. And people concerned about privacy should probably be a little bit more concerned about what's being collected by Google than on telematics devices. How can we see telematics solutions assist in delivering more efficient claims services? Is this linking with our suppliers immediately, linking with tow trucks, emergency services, and being able to get to an accident site and prevent, and I suppose prevent in some way, bodily injury? The faster someone gets there, the more chance someone has of survival. So the legacy system. So legacy systems are always seen as, I suppose, a challenge and a barrier to the introduction of telematics within the Australian marketplace. So many insurers have legacy systems that they're managing and would think they need to spend money on to be able to offer a telematics solution. This is no longer the case because there are telematics providers out there that are able to run the whole telematics solution for you. So it's whether it aligns with your business strategy. Does telematics have a role in the share economy? So the Uber of the world. Is this something that could be a proposition for insurers going forward? So Uber has had a lot of press recently. There's some challenges around CTP, and there's challenges just in general about insuring those vehicles. But is telematics a way that to be able to offer an insurance product that actually suits the segment? So has the impact of telematics on CGP been appropriately considered? So when I listened to Jess's very interesting presentation, so the link to CGP is evident. If you have a telematics device or you have a transmission device within your car, emergency services can respond if we were able to set that up appropriately within Australia. So there is a link there to protecting our consumers and all our motorists. With the integrated lifestyle proposition, what part does telematics play? It has a role, but what will that be going forward? So with all insurers, the marketplace is talking about customer-centric development of product and pricing. Telematics enables this because it is customer-driven. They are actually defining their product and defining their price. We now have the ability to capitalise enhanced data sets. So the technology is supporting this. We are able to manage big data sets, as they are now, or just data sets that are large. So the technology and the support behind this, it's no longer a barrier for most insurers. And does it, as the insurance market changes, we go to driverless cars or different products, does this actually allow insurers to have a different revenue stream? There's value-added services. There's potential in those value-added services to have a different revenue stream that isn't dependent on people's ability to drive. So this is my final slide. So will it actually impact the GI industry? Is it telematics or is it just technology and customers' expectations? My view is it's all of them. Telematics is a technology, but it needs to be supported by other technology, and it needs to become part of the customer's accepted reality. But we need to develop propositions that actually meet customers' expectations. So I suppose this is a question for the audience. Is there a choice with the connected car? We do have connected cars. We are going to be able to link in. There's web services available. Telematics will be available, and manufacturers are putting it into their cars. So are insurers going to capitalise this, or are we not going to develop those telematics propositions going forward? So that's the end of my presentation. Happy to take any questions. David will have some for us later.
Thank you, Natasha. I guess one of my reflections, I think on a theme that came up through your presentation is around the competing forces that are technology and privacy. I feel that they kind of work against each other, and I feel that the technology is a bit of an inexorable force that will at some point get the better of privacy, but whether that's in 2 years or whether that's within the 10 years, I guess is probably a question for us. So I'd now like to introduce our third speaker for the session, who will be taking a slightly different tack, if you'll pardon the expression there. that was terrible. Professor Alex Colley is the Chief Executive Officer of ISCA. ISCA is the Institute of Safety Compensation and Recovery Research. He's held research leadership roles in academia, government and industry for the past 15 years. Prior to joining ISCA, he was the Executive Director of the Victorian Neurotrauma Initiative, a state government brain and spinal cord injury research fund, and a subsidiary of the TAC. Alex is also adjunct professor in research in the Department of Epidemiology and Preventive Medicine at Monash University. He established the Victorian Compensation Research Database, a unique research platform which is now used internationally for occupational health and safety, compensation systems, and return to work research. So, Alex will be sharing with us some of the work being done around some emerging medical and rehabilitative technologies. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, David. I get a nice opportunity to combine a couple of my interests today. I'm going to talk mainly about spinal cord injury and injury compensation and just how technology is playing a difference in rehabilitation and recovery, or potentially playing a difference in rehabilitation and recovery. And I'm going to do that through the lens of a particular project that we've been running at ISCA for the last couple of years, which is looking at horizon scanning for healthcare technologies. Thanks. I probably need more slides. That will make me through. You mentioned disruptive technology when we started, and you mentioned Netflix, David. It's certainly been a disruptive technology in my house. I don't know what my kids have been doing for the last month, but my internet ran out last week, and I was ill and at home and trying to email this presentation, so I think it took about an hour to come through. So these things do impact our day-to-day lives pretty commonly. There's a whole bunch of people I want to acknowledge who've been involved in this project. A few of them there on the title slide, and more you'll see at the end. This is something we did at ISCA with a group in Canada called CADTH, the Canadian, I'll get it wrong, Canadian Association of Disability and Technology in Healthcare, something like that, and they've been doing this in healthcare for quite a while. There's a small group of organisations around the world that do this horizon scanning business, sort of looking over the horizon, trying to figure out what technologies are going to be used commonly in healthcare and rehabilitation in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years. And we found ourselves through our work with WorkSafe and TAC being one of only a couple of places in Australia that are really doing this in any significant way. It's been an interesting process to be involved in. I'll take you through the rationale for the project first and then talk a bit more about some of the specific technologies that we're looking at, and hope to prompt some questions from you in the discussion afterwards. So we started this last year, beginning of last year, December 2013, January 2014. And it really came about in response to quite a number of literature reviews of evidence that we were being asked to do by TAC and WorkSafe to help them formulate policy positions about new technologies, things that they were being asked to pay for by their clients. Things like implantable pain therapies for sort of spinal cord stimulators and other things that are increasingly used by people with persistent pain and other things after traumatic injuries. And a range of other technologies where the compensation authorities were being asked to consider paying for these things. And our role was to go and look at the research evidence and say whether or not evidence supported their use, whether they were effective, whether they were efficient, those sorts of things. And we thought, well, being responsive is good. Being proactive is probably a bit better, and actually looking over the horizon to see what's coming down the track would be a good thing to do. So we established this project to try to identify and track emerging health technologies, and not just devices or drugs, but also services and treatments that might have the potential to improve the lives of people who've been injured at work or on the roads. And we think what we're hopefully able to do is give the people who are potentially going to have to pay for these technologies advance warning that they're coming, and to begin to prepare for them. So increasing the awareness of new and emerging technologies. And the range of other benefits we think the project can deliver for organisations like WorkSafe and TAC. The way we do it is pretty simple. What we do is look around at a whole range of different databases that are usually publicly available things. So from published research literature to news services, to trial registries, to material published in conference proceedings. It's just documentation that's out there from a whole range of sources. And we scan that and bring it together. And that's sort of the base material for the Horizon scan. So the first step in the model was to identify those information sources. And then we have a group of people at TAC, at WorkSafe, and at ISCA who run basically through a filter process. The first time we did this, we identified 40 potentially relevant technologies that we thought were either were emerging in the market, that were being trialled or at an early stage of development, likely to be used in the next few years in practice, that weren't quite adopted in established healthcare settings but looked like they were getting there, or that existed but just hadn't been diffused yet. They've been demonstrated to be effective, but hadn't sort of been diffused into healthcare. So we found 40 through a process of reviewing them and narrowing them down with an advisory group. We got that down to 10, which we put in a little newsletter, which is on our website now. People can go and have a look at. And then we chose two of those to go into more detail. I'm just going to take you through a couple of the examples of things that we've seen along the way. I'm going to talk about three or four things. But all the information is available on our website. What we do with it is we've done this twice now, so we produce newsletters and information. I've got an example, if anyone wants to see it, of one here, but the PDFs are on the website. It's just a summary document that sort of says, here's the technologies we found, and here's the stage of development, and what they are, and how they might be applicable. There's a listing. I won't go through it. I'll take you into some of the specific examples. And that's just how we communicate the findings. So I wanted to focus mainly just on one injury type, just to sort of make it a bit more manageable to talk about, and also because a lot of the work that we did early on was on spinal cord injury. So if you know anything about spinal cord injury, transport accidents are the leading cause of traumatic spinal cord injury, accounting for about half of all cases, and clearly, they have a pretty significant cost to insurers and injury compensation systems, and also lead to pretty significant health issues for the people that are injured, and have lots of other sort of flow-on effects for family members and community, etc., etc. And there are a couple of things I wanted to mention. One is how we can help some technologies that can help people with paraplegia and potentially more severe injuries to regain function, and then this is one of them, and then some technologies that might help to reduce the very significant secondary consequences of spinal cord injury. One of the things that occurs in spinal cord injuries, people with those injuries become susceptible to other health-related conditions like pressure ulcers because they can't move, like urinary tract infections because they have trouble eliminating their bowels and their bladder, and all sorts of other things that can cause things like readmission to hospital, can make it difficult for them to re-engage in society, to work, to do all those sorts of things. So this was one of the technologies that we found, and there were about two or three of these that came through our scan, sort of, if you like, exoskeletons to help people with paraplegia to walk. And this is just one that I've chosen because it's sort of imminent. It's on the horizon. This is currently used and FDA approved in America. So the Food and Drug Administration in the US has given this its approval. Not so in Australia. Its intention is to help people with spinal cord injury to learn to walk again, to help them get up and about. It's a piece of infrastructure that's based on sort of US military technology. I'm not sure if, I can't remember the name of the movie, some of you might have seen it, that Tom Cruise was in recently, where he keeps having the same, going back in the same day, where he's in this sort of exoskeleton suit. It's that kind of technology, very futuristic technology that they've converted for use by people with paraplegia. So this particular one's been trialled in 12 rehabilitation hospitals in the US. It costs about $130,000 per unit, and it has FDA approval. It's not in Australia at the moment. It doesn't have regulatory approval in Australia for use, but you can imagine in the not-too-distant future it will, and organisations like the TAC are going to be asked to pay for it at about $130 per kit. And they're also developing, at the moment it's developed for use in rehabilitation hospitals, but the company that is working on this is developing one for use in the community, for use in people with paraplegia, just in their day-to-day lives. So that's one that we think is kind of not too far away. I'll come back to this one because it's a bit different. I love the name of this one. I'm not sure which marketing team came up with the name for this one. Smarty Pants for pressure ulcers. And this is, it's a, quite a simple concept really when you think about it. When you understand the physiology of what leads to pressure ulcers, it's basically just compression of the skin against the bone with the muscle in between. And the muscle starts to break down in really deep pressure ulcers. And there is some evidence to suggest that if you can stimulate the muscle through some electric pulses to move a little bit better and increase the blood flow to the areas where the pressure is being applied, then you can reduce the incidence and the severity of pressure ulcers. Now, pressure ulcers are, I think, the second leading cause for readmission to hospital in people with spinal cord injury, and not just in people with spinal cord injury, people in intensive care units, older people who are immobile, lots of other people have issues with pressure ulcers. And so this company has developed a technology which is literally a pair of underpants with electrical stimulation devices in them that basically just that just help to stimulate the muscles and have been shown in some trials to be tolerable. They don't interfere with rehabilitation well tolerated by patients. There's limited data on the efficacy of these yet. Whether they actually work or not is yet to be determined. But again, a sensible idea. There's a company pursuing this, and it may not be in the too distant future that we see these being made available to people who are immobile. This one is an example of something that is getting a lot of use in Europe. It has approval by some of the regulatory agencies there, also in the USA, and the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia has approved one example of these catheters for use in Australia. It's basically, again, one of the complications of spinal cord injury is the requirement to have an indwelling catheter in a lot of people because they have trouble entering their bladder, emptying their bladder. And so the solution to that historically has been to put an indwelling catheter in so that the person can empty their bladder without having to try too hard. And that often leads to secondary infections. And so this is essentially a catheter with a silver alloy coating that reduces the likelihood of bacteria sticking to the catheter and causing those infections. So it's kind of a simple technological solution. It doesn't change the device that's used at all. It just changes the coating of the device that's used. And these are more expensive. They're used now, as I mentioned, they're in use in the UK and the US and beginning to be used in Australia. Potentially have a pretty good impact, potentially, on reducing the incidence and the severity of UTIs in patients with spinal cord injury. But there's not a huge amount of evidence around at the moment. So again, another technology that came through the scan that is likely in the not too distant future to be in common use. It's more expensive and it's likely to start costing organisations that pay for these sorts of things a little bit more money as we go forward. So there's some examples of trying to restore function through an exoskeleton for someone with spinal cord injury and trying to reduce the consequences, the secondary consequences of an injury like that, both of which can be sort of quite expensive things. And I just wanted to give one other example, because we did find a number of other things as we did this scan. And this is actually something out of Western Australia. And it's interesting to me because I'm a public health researcher. Essentially in WA, what the government over there has done, the health department, has described a new model of care for musculoskeletal disease management. What we're trying to do with this horizon scanning approach is move it out of just technologies and move it into those, but also looking at services and management programs and things in healthcare. And if you know anything about musculoskeletal disorders and conditions, there are, I think, three of the top five burdens of disease in Australia, according to the World Health Organization. Things like arthritis and back pain are huge burdens of illness and burdens of disability in Australia. And our management programs for them tend to be pretty poor. We're not that good at dealing with musculoskeletal disease. They're certainly one of the most common things that we see in workers' compensation systems and, you know, probably result in the greatest costs in workers' comp systems in Australia. And what the WA Department of Health has done is designed a new population health service delivery model, which they're attempting to roll out across the state. And it's basically a community-based disease management model that has a number of different elements to it, which I won't go into in detail, but it's just an indication. I wanted to give this as an example of something other than a sort of a specific technology that can come through these sorts of scanning approaches. I thought, here's the people I need to acknowledge who've been working on this. I thought I'd leave it there and open it for questions.
Thank you, Alex. Just speaking certainly from a TAC perspective, spinal cord injury is incredibly expensive. I think an individual with quadriplegia has an average lifetime cost of approximately $5 million. Paraplegia is over $1 million. How much have we spent on the research, Alex, the Horizon scan? Yeah, so money pretty well spent from the TAC's point of view, I would say, that is. So I think that was three fascinating presentations, as I say, each of which really opened us up to some of the technological developments out there and the impact they may have on the insurance industry. So I've got some time for questions. I'll take advantage of being at the microphone just to kick us off, and I'll start with a question that I'll hopefully get a response from each of our speakers on. What I'd just like each of you to do, briefly, if you could, is based on the presentations we've heard this morning, I'd like a bold prediction from each of you, as to something we'll see in 10 years' time that will be very different to what we see today. Jess, happy to go first?
I think definitely in the next 10 to 15 years, driverless cars will be the next frontier in terms of vehicle safety. And I think in terms of reducing road trauma, that is also going to be a big thing for us, because understanding, I guess, from a human perspective, we're all going to make mistakes. And we see that played out on the roads every day. So changing human behaviour is going to be a hard thing. So we have to look at other ways to be able to, you know, accommodate for the mistake that people are going to inevitably make. And that is either going to involve designing the roads to be able to accommodate some of those mistakes, or having vehicle safety technologies that can take the decisions away from the driver and be able to keep them safe on the road. So I think definitely vehicle safety and technologies and the driverless car is something you're going to see progressively in the next 10 years or so.
Natasha? I agree actually with Jess on that. I do think that they driverless cars are coming. But I'm sort of taking the view that you just highlighted as well, David. I do believe that customers' views on privacy will change and what is accepted as private data and public data. So I actually do think that technology will underpin that change in behaviour and also views on what is private and public data, which will change our industry and probably change the insurance responses.
A follow-on question without notice, if I could. Do you think that will happen within existing legislation, or will there need to be legislative change around privacy as well?
I think the existing legislation actually provides a framework to work within, but I just think that people's perception will be different. Insurers and all entities actually have to protect data. I just think people will accept a different level of interaction in their lives.
Thank you. Alex.
Great. Yeah, driverless cars, absolutely. And I think generally that as a trend, I guess I would say that what we're doing now is taking human out of the equation. And we've seen that a lot in work, health and safety over the years in guarding machines and trying to eliminate all the stupid things that humans do. It's got to be a good thing. I think what we're seeing at the moment as well, another thing I really hope we see in the next 10 years or so, because I think it's an essential piece of infrastructure for our country, is a unique health identifier. There's just so much waste in healthcare in Australia, and all of the data sets are completely fragmented. And I look at things like the TAC's injury compensation data and WorkSafe injury data and the Department of Health and Victoria's data. And as you know, we've been doing some work trying to link them all together to try to create a more complete picture of actually what's happening in rehabilitation recovery. And I think we're at the, you can kind of see that conversation beginning to happen a bit more publicly now. Other countries are doing it. There's a huge potential value in doing that. A lot of potential to save costs, as well as deliver more effective treatments and services. And I think, I really hope in the next 10 years we get over that hurdle and then start to derive the benefits from doing it.
Has anyone put a figure on what that waste is? If not, probably an opportunity for some consultants out there.
I think the one recently, I can't remember what it was, I think it was from one of our Institute of Health and Welfare, it was an enormous number billions of dollars per hour. I can't remember the exact figure.
All right, that was pretty good. I think that's done well. So we'll just move to the floor now, Estelle. I'll start with you because you're in the front here.
Of course, most of this is bad news for insurers, isn't it? Because with driverless cars, fewer accidents, telematics, etc., that just takes premium out of the market. And it's sort of, telematics is an interesting thing, isn't it? You know, you can use it to find the better risk, charge them a lower price. That leaves you with higher risk people who would have higher premiums, maybe in reduced insurance take up, or they would change and reduce their risk. So in the end, the end outcome is less premium. To me, it seems, and I think, Natasha, you touched on this, that the challenge for insurers is therefore to not see the technology as just an opportunity to identify risk better and charge for risk better, but to actually change the customer relationship. And I think the research is that the younger generation value advice and will pay for advice. So you could imagine connected cars, using those technologies to provide customers with advice about, you know, how to drive more fuel efficiently, how to take a more efficient route,
where fuel's the cheapest for them at the moment with connected homes in terms of energy bills, etc. So I think that's a real challenge for insurers, because generally, I say, when we talk about technology and technological changes, it actually, for the insurers, means a reduction in their premium bill.
I agree, Estella, absolutely. And I think that that's where we have to identify different revenue streams. There's an insurer in the UK that has developed a 3-year insurance policy, which is interesting, we can't do that here at the moment. I think it's £450, and it offers driver training to like our P-platers, as well as telematics insurance. So they've bundled that, and that's their value-added service. So it's a different approach to insurance products.
I don't want to offend any insurers in the room, but I think it's a wonderful thing. Probably should be aiming for it, in my opinion.
Crystal from IAG. I found the health stuff fascinating, but I'm going to stick with driverless cars. And more in society's expectations about how fallible driverless cars can be. So there was a really interesting article that came out about the Google cars a few weeks ago that did the rounds on social media, probably on Twitter and stuff. And there was almost shock and outrage that Google cars had actually crashed. I think it was 11 times in however many million kilometres of driving. And Google had to put out a press release saying, no, 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 it was other people crashing into our cars or worse to that effect. So my reaction to that was, well, who cares? 11 times is still better than people. So how do we get past society's expectations, which might be that this technology is infallible, and actually allow themselves to give up control of something to technology that might well still injure them?
Jess, want to have a go?
So as a TAC, we regularly do market research to sort of gain an understanding of where the community is at with different technologies. And we did some market research recently around a few other technologies. And what we know from the consumer's point of view is they need to see evidence that it works. So until they can actually see evidence that it works and understand how technology works in different situations, they are less likely to ask for it or adopt a certain technology. So certainly driverless car may not be that far away, but it's still in the next 10 years or so. And, you know, there are different levels of automation, and it may take a bit of time before they get up to that full level of automation. So in between, like I said, I mentioned cruise control, AEB, that could be your first level of automation. And the second one would be where the car can drive itself, but it would still need the driver to be back in control in certain situations where the car can't make that decision for themselves. So I think it will take a bit of time, but I think once the evidence starts to grow, that's when you will start to bring the consumer along with you.
I just wanted to make a point here. We seem to be assuming that the only reason people get into a car is to get from A to B. I think, again, looking at different consumers and different preferences, there is a proportion of the population that actually derive enjoyment from driving their car. So I guess, are we considering a world where people can only do that in confined, like, raceways where they can go and pay money to experience the joy of being in control of the car, and that on public roads we would all be confined to effectively a train carriage that is an individual thing that moves along roads? Is that the world we're looking at, or do you think you see some sort of hybrid?
Good question. I don't think it's not as if next year we're all going to be driving Google cars. What will happen over time is there will be incremental changes to the technology that will probably take much longer than 10 years. I think it will probably take 20 or 30 or longer years before we're in a world where most of the cars don't require any human intervention. And I think what will happen is society's expectations will change with that technology over that period of time. So I get a lot of enjoyment of being in control of my car as well, but there are times where I'd just rather jump on a train in Melbourne and not have to worry about it. I think our expectations of our transport generally are going to change quite a lot. It'd be much easier if we just invested in the safer public transport, safer transport options we have now, which are trains and trams. Yeah, not too many people die in train accidents in Melbourne, I've got to tell you, or train accidents. There are a few, but not very many. So a much better public health response to the issue of road safety would actually be investing in public transport rather than encouraging organisations like Google to make driverless cars. But that's a different political narrative completely.
But again, you're still stuck with the proposition that that's something that the population wants to do. I'm a believer that anything that you see in a movie is a possibility that it could be true one day. And so sort of looking at this utopian society where there are no car accidents sort of leads you to a belief that, well, our individual freedoms don't have to be sacrificed to the extent of no road deaths. And then where do you draw the line with other parts of social activity? You know, I guess if we're all sitting in a big environment like the Matrix and we're all just plugged in, none of us are dying. So is that the ultimate goal? Because then there are no road safety deaths. We're all just all plugged into the Matrix. So where between the two do we stop?
Yeah. That's why it's not going to happen in 10 years, because that individual liberty versus sort of public good argument has to play out. We're only in the beginnings of it. That's going to take decades to get through, I reckon. It will progress, I think. I think what we'll see is the technology, as it already has, with cruise control and airbags and all these sorts of things, will incrementally come in. And at some point, we're going to reach a point where we have to have that discussion. Are we giving up too much of our individual freedom in order to the same thing happens in bicycle helmet wearing in Victoria and probably in other states as well. This issue about mandated bicycle helmet wearing and whether that is actually a public health, net public health benefit. Because what happened when bicycle helmet laws came in is a lot of people stopped riding their bikes. And so people aren't fit, and the cost of the health is. So you can make an argument if you want to construct it that mandatory bicycle helmet wearing has been bad for public health, even though it's saving people's lives. So these sorts of things don't often get. I think that'll happen over the next sort of 20 or 30 years, but that's why it's not going to happen in 10 years. We won't be in Google cars in 10 years.
I think the question you pose is a wider ethical issue that the society is going to have to debate. I mean, obviously at the TAC, our vision is for zero road deaths and serious injuries. And road trauma really just affects the person that is involved. You know, there's the family, there's friends, there's all the personnel that's involved in, you know, clearing up the accident and looking after the people that's been injured. I mean, I saw a really interesting presentation presented by an ethicist at Monash, and the question that was posed was, well, if you actually know that driverless vehicles or autonomous vehicles are actually going to be a lot safer for the society as a whole, would you then allow individuals that can put others at risk to continue driving? And that's the question that we're going to have to discuss as we move further towards that end goal. Now, I don't think I've got an answer at the moment whether or not we should allow people to continue driving. So.
Yeah. I think we're going in.
Should we all stop playing sport because every now and then someone gets killed?
Zero cholesterol deaths. Yeah, let's go for it. Let's stop alcohol. I think we're going down a philosophical path to 10 litres.
Yeah, take us back out of that.
A very long debate. I do want to pick up one thing on Estelle's point that insurers aren't about transferring the average claims cost. We're actually about reducing the volatility and looking after people for the unexpected. So the fact that the average drops off and that sort of thing does mean the insurance business models have to change, but the fundamental of taking away uncertainty and helping manage risk is what we're all about. So that doesn't matter that the premium volume and the transfer of crashes and bashes and bumps and scrapes stops happening. I mean, it does rather. And I'm quite surprised that everyone's just focusing on road transport as the fundamental change. there are so many other things going on out there. I'm just like to throw out to the panel and probably anybody else why things such as the way your white goods and everything are going to be connected, the connected house, for example, that changes how we can monitor and manage risk in the house just as equally as we can. Probably it doesn't hit the human safety element to it unless Julie built something in the fridge that says I'm not allowed cheese or whatever, so my cholesterol levels are controlled. But there's a lot of other changes going in there. So what in your mind threw everything to the driverless car over and above anything else? Question for all of them.
The question was about based on the presentations that we've seen, so that's why. But I agree, So I had another one, of course, which wasn't this driver's car, I think. So my other one, I'm a public health researcher, so my issue is about how healthcare systems can work more effectively, and I think there's huge capability there. Another one for me would be communication technologies, not between devices and things in your house or your cars, but between people. Because, again, using my own experience, which is injury compensation schemes, one of the things that our research and those of others is showing pretty clearly now is that a lot of the waste that occurs in rehabilitation systems and a lot of the issues that crop up in those systems that cause people to take longer off work and to take longer to recover are due to poor communication between the parties involved in rehabilitation. GPs not speaking to employers, not speaking to insurers, to injured people, to healthcare providers. And if we can come up with a way of solving that dilemma, which we should be able to with all of the various social media gadgetry that's around now, that would make an enormous difference, I think, for rehabilitation and recovery after injury, or after any health condition, really. But I went saw my doctor last week, had a blood test, and it needed to be sent to someone else, and he printed that out and put it in a letter and sent it off, you know. And so then I had to wait 3 days until I called that other doctor to get, you know, to speak to him. So we're still operating in the 20th century. Things should have moved on by now, really, I reckon.
Question back there.
Hi, Dan from Investment Magazine. I'm just wondering what you think the impact of technology will be on insurance through superannuation.
Of life insurance through superannuation?
Life insurance or TPD, because obviously with the Bionic Sue, that's it's fantastic technology, but that's going to have impacts. So I'm just wondering what the panel's thoughts are on that.
Few blank looks. I suppose. I guess from my personal point of view, I would have thought. I would have thought some of that technology would benefit super funds, or you know, would have a favourable impact on rates of TPD and death. I couldn't speak to what relative impact that would be. Certainly would have thought it would have one. I don't know if anyone else has. Tim wants. Go, Tim.
Just from my history, at least, life insurance. So there's a fairly high proportion of those claims are actually medical disability and physical responses. Well, they help medical disability because often medical disability comes from a physical thing, and then life gets a bit tough and it gets a bit hard on you. So it'll have some reduction, but not as much as you would naturally think compared to physical trauma that you see through the road accident area. But there will be some.
Probably along a similar vein, I guess one of the, you're talking about the motor frequency would be coming down. I think some of that, and some of that insurance premium going down as well, that would likely be transferred to liability insurance on the manufacturers of things like the driverless cars. So I was wondering if the TAC have done anything on, is there, how much has been recovered from accidents that have been caused by some of the technology, so the AEC, the automatic braking and if some of those things go wrong. And then I guess along similarly to the to Alex's presentation, the consumer's, I guess, ability to pay the insurance premiums that will be needed to be able to pay for some of these bionic suits and things like that. So as the frequency drops, people won't feel like they need to pay much insurance because these accidents are so rare, but when they do happen, they're expensive because there's higher liability premiums, there's higher CTP premiums because of the technology is just costing, the cost of that would be a lot more.
And so the last bit. So I think what we already see, I think, is that while the technology, the cost of the technology itself might be quite high, what it enables a person to do leads to offsets in costs elsewhere. So, for instance, if you're a paramedic, you can walk with one of those exoskeletons. So you can do a lot more for yourself. You require less care, which is a quite a significant cost saving to a sort of lifetime care insurer like TSC.
But I guess for the person who's injured, that's fair enough. But the insurance, like the whole premium, the whole body of insureds, every motorist needs to pay for, has to spread this cost. But with less accidents, they don't feel like they're getting a bang for their buck, I guess.
Probably one of the reasons it's compulsory. So we have to do that so that it's actually shared across the organisation. But
talk about insurance. I mean, if there are political issues about insurance affordability, and this is, you know, I imagine would increase some of those costs.
I think the offsetting costs from the care perspective, and we have a real critical issue in Australia around caregivers.
Yeah.
And as more lifetime care comes on board, it's been identified as one of the key issues in Australia around our employment and also being able to give that care. So if we can actually take people out of that care system, enable them to go back to life, hopefully, that they were living before that accident. So it probably would offset those costs.
It's a good question in that you don't, at least I don't see, as these new technologies come through, very many cost effectiveness analyses done, very good quality ones anyway. I get them all the time at PBAC and those sorts of things for new, you know, blockbuster drugs and all that sort of stuff. But at the level of the sort of regular state based injury regulatory authorities, you know, they're the sort of decisions that may sort of need that information. And my hypothesis would be, which you need to test, would be that things like these technologies would have a net economic benefit given other costs that are sort of defrayed later in life or whatever. But we may need to start testing some of those sort of things.
Can I just add, in terms of the technologies, a lot of the technologies I sort of mentioned in my presentation, they're designed as driver assistance technologies. So even in the event that they do fail, they won't actually cause an accident. They might not function and prevent the accident, but in and of itself, it actually won't cause the driver to crash. So I think from the accident data that we've got in terms of crashes being linked back to a vehicle defect is actually quite small compared to some of the road safety issues that we're facing, such as drink driving, speeding. Those tend to be the much larger issues that we're facing at the moment. Not to say that vehicle safety defects isn't an issue, but in the scheme of things, it's probably not as large an issue as some of the other things we're seeing.
I'm going to ask two totally different questions. First of all, I'd be interested in your comments on affordability issues. And I guess, you know, the safer cars, the driverless cars, they're going to be new vehicles, more expensive vehicles. So it's going to be the take-up of technology probably by the wealthier. And therefore, for those who are less wealthy, they will be driving less safe vehicles and their insurance premiums will be much higher. So I'd just be interested in your comments there about affordability and when we have an issue like we do in property insurance in terms of Far North Queensland. And then secondly, Alex, I'm not sure it's an insurance question, maybe it's got something to do with medical negligence. I was interested to read about the technologies that have been developed about home diagnosis, where you have, through your phone, I think it is, you can sort of take various scans and things like that, and then they get sent online that gives you a sort of a diagnosis, and then you might be connected with a practitioner who then talks to you. And I understand you can't do that in Australia, but they do that in the US. What impact that would have on healthcare?
Just on the first question, Estelle, if I could, I mentioned before I was an early adopter of the autonomous braking, but look, I think that's an example where that was 5 years ago and it is getting pretty widespread now, so I think your point's not a bad one. I think it's a matter of time, and I think most of, you know, the forces of technology just make it cheaper. So I would have thought each of them early on will be, you know, would be the wealthier who can take them up, but I'd expect that, you know, the technology would, they'll get cheaper and more affordable. And Alex, maybe just to finish us off.
The first one, that already happens now. The reason that we have the client population, we have organisations like TSC, is because people with lower incomes can't afford the safe cars. And if they get injured much more severely than wealthier people who can't. So it's already an issue. It'll just be exacerbated as technology advances. Telemedicine, on the second question, is really... I think it has huge potential. I think both for good and evil. And if we use it wisely in certain conditions and indications, it can be really beneficial. There's already some good evidence about telephone-based cognitive behavioural therapy for people with mental health conditions. A lot of that work's been done here in Sydney. And there's all sorts of possible applications of it. I'm not sure that we're adopting it as rapidly as many of us thought we might, sort of 10 or 15 or 20 years ago when it sort of started. And, I'm not sure what's stopping that. It's not an area that I have a lot of expertise in telemedicine, but there's certainly potential there. It's kind of what I was getting at with that connectivity thing as well. It's a bit related, I think. Making it easier to see a healthcare provider of a certain persuasion is got to be a good thing. But there are all sorts of factors that need to be considered in doing that. You know, it's hard enough to go and get in front of your GP at the moment. Are we going to ask GPs all of a sudden to do things via video link to rural areas and those sorts of things? There's all sorts of infrastructure problems, I think, that go beyond the actual physical infrastructure that need to be sorted out to make it work really well.
Very quick. That's okay.
The connected system is very logically the risk of having a cyber attack. So this is the comment I'm making, that we have to become more people with their taking for our systems, we can't just use it at home. There is that significant exposure, and then that potentially becomes an uninsurable risk, and then much more back into government. So I just want that point that one to be.
All right. Well, look, I think the discussion certainly could continue, but I'll draw it to a close there. I'll firstly just once again thank Taylor Fry as our sponsor for the session, and I'd hope from their point of view, I think that the presentations were fascinating. I think it was an excellent discussion we had. We're going for lunch now. We'll be guided by the wonderful Institute staff who'll lead us from here to the Menzies Hotel, which is just next door. So. They'll take us there. We'll be resuming at 1:35 p.m. So we've got a good break for everyone. And finally, if you could just join me in thanking our three speakers once again. Thank you.